Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. Mark Bowden is the author of nine previous books, including the number one New York Times bestseller and the National Book Award finalist Black Hawk Down. He's a columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer, where he served as a staff writer from 1979 to 2003. He's also a national correspondent at the Atlantic Monthly and has been a contributing editor at Vanity Fair since 2008. We're delighted that Mark Bowden has returned to the Tattered Cover tonight to present The Finish, The Killing of Osama Bin Laden. Our second guest this evening, Gregory Johnson, is a former Fulbright Fellow in Yemen and a PhD candidate in Near Eastern Studies at Princeton. He has written for a variety of publications, including Foreign Policy, The New York Times, Newsweek, and The Boston Globe. A frequent commentator on NPR and CNN, he has also been a Fulbright Hayes Fellow in Egypt and a Peace Corps volunteer in Jordan. Gregory Johnson is with us tonight to present The Last Refuge, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's War in Arabia. We're going to ask Mark Bowden to join us at the podium first, but before that, would you please join me in welcoming both of our guests.
I suppose this is a case of age before credentials. Thank you all for coming. I'm always delighted to come to the Tattered Cover. It's one of the great bookstores in America, and they host wonderful events. And, you know, these kinds of bookstores are sadly increasingly rare. So, you know, it is something that I'm just thrilled about when I get the chance to do it. I'm also really delighted to have a chance to talk about this book now that this great political storm has passed by. You know, you can't write or say or do anything in America during an election cycle without it being interpreted through some political lens by one side or the other. And, you know, I really think that the successful effort to find and kill Osama bin Laden was truly an American success story. It's not the success of one administration or the other. I know President Bush would have loved to have found bin Laden during his second term, and President Obama deserves, all the credit in the world for successfully pushing and overseeing this operation through the gathering of intelligence to the actual mission itself. It is worth thinking back to the previous election year in 2007 when Barack Obama, then running for president, gave a speech at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington in which he said that if he, as president, were to get actionable intelligence that someone like Osama bin Laden was hiding inside Pakistan, that he would be willing to act unilaterally to go after that target. For making that statement, he was roundly condemned by everyone. And when I say everyone, I mean everyone. There was nobody who was enthusiastic about that. And even though he had carefully crafted his remarks to say that he was talking about a specific individual and about actionable intelligence, that remark was widely misreported and I think somewhat deliberately distorted because of the political campaign. But, you know, my fellow journalists were also responsible for it. I know that the New York Times, the day after he gave the speech, reported that Obama had, quote, vowed to dispatch American soldiers to eradicate terrorist camps in Pakistan. The subhead on the story in the Los Angeles Times said he says he'd reserve the right to invade Pakistan. Liberals accused Obama of embracing the Bush administration's cowboy mentality. Conservatives faulted Obama for a supposed lack of sophistication. A liberal blogger, Jerome Armstrong, wrote, "For progressive Democrats who want a more peaceful leadership in the world, Obama's speech fails the threshold of getting us out of picking fights in the Middle East and discarding the Bush doctrine of preemptive attacks." Conservative columnist William Kristol wrote that Obama was, quote, frantically suggesting that he would invade Pakistan in order to shore up his tough guy credentials against Hillary Clinton. Rush Limbaugh, who was having a lot of fun mocking Obama during that campaign, claimed that Osama bin Laden, and he said, "I get these guys mixed up, Osama and Obama," had been exhorting his followers, bin Laden had, to overthrow President Musharraf in Pakistan. And he says now, Obama says that if he gets elected, he's going to invade Pakistan. He said, "Poor Musharraf is going to get it on both ends if Obama is elected." The Pakistani government complained. The Bush administration apologized. Mitt Romney, who was then the front runner for president for the Republican nomination back in 2007, said, "I do not concur in the words of Barack Obama in a plan to attack an ally of ours. I don't think these kinds of comments help." Well, 4 years later, after, as president, Obama had done exactly what he said he was going to do, a lot of these same folks said, well, anybody would have done that in his position. That this was a no-brainer, right, for the president. Such are the rewards of public service in the nation's highest office. In fact, this was not a no-brainer. Anyone who fairly assesses the decision that was made to launch this mission into Abbottabad realizes that. And when Admiral Bill McRaven outlined this proposed mission for the first time to the president, he noted that, you know, Pakistan is no slouch as a military power. They're a nuclear power. They have very sophisticated radar, ground-to-air capabilities. They have an Air Force with F-16s. They have a professional army. And the idea of invading their space without letting them know with a military force was risky, to say the least, just in and of itself. He explained to the president that the mission to Abbottabad would take about an hour and a half for helicopters leaving Afghanistan to reach the target. They would, he said, to take down the compound where bin Laden was thought to be hiding, he said it would take about 40 minutes, he felt, if everything went smoothly. Then there would be another 40-minute flight northeast to a rendezvous point with two Chinooks to refuel the Black Hawks, and then another hour and a half flight back to Afghanistan. So that's a four-hour incursion into Pakistan, which has to be done without tripping any alarms in that country, because as good as these SEALs are, and as good as these helicopter pilots are, they would obviously be no match for the Pakistani army and Air Force. He also told the president that, you know, remember those 40 minutes on the ground in the compound depend on things going smoothly. He said, if, for instance, my men are fired upon, if there's a firefight, I think, you know, my men will prevail, but it will delay us. There's also been many instances in raids that they had done in the past where they'd gotten to the right place, but the target was hiding. If, for instance, they get to this compound in Abbottabad and they find bin Laden's wives and children and associates all there, but no bin Laden, he says, well, we're not going to just leave at that point. We're going to, you know, if he's hiding behind a trick wall or if he's hiding in a bunker underground, we're going to take that place apart before we leave. But that's going to take us more time. So the longer they stay, the greater the chances of tripping alarms in Pakistan. He told the president ultimately that it wasn't just possible that they would end up in a confrontation, but probable that they would, if they were delayed in some way. So what did that mean? obviously, the SEALs are not going to be able to fight off a concerted attack by the Pakistani military. So he proposed, Admiral McGraven proposed, that they hunker down in the compound and wait for Washington to negotiate their extraction with Islamabad. That was Admiral McGraven's proposal. And the president, to his credit, said, no, I'm not going to put those men in that position. If you go, you need to go prepared to fight your way out of the country, if necessary. And what that meant was adding infantry who sat in helicopters just inside the border of Afghanistan and alerting the United States Air Force to go in and escort those helicopters out if necessary. What it meant was the possibility of getting in a shooting war with our ally Pakistan, which would have meant almost certainly a lot of dead Pakistanis and very possibly some dead American soldiers. So this was not a risk-free operation by any stretch, especially because the president told me that his estimate of bin Laden actually being there was only 50-50 at best. And he had a very attractive option of firing a small missile, a missile about the size of my forearm, from a small drone at the individual who they all called the pacer, the man who would take walks inside the compound around a vegetable garden. And the missile, if it worked, would strike just that man and kill him. No American personnel put in harm's way. If they hit bin Laden, mission accomplished. If the missile misses, there's an unexplained explosion in Abbottabad. The downside to this option was obviously, how would they know? You know, are the Pakistanis going to let our forensic experts go in and figure out if, in the bits and pieces that remain, this was in fact bin Laden? I would say also a fairly enormous downside is if it in fact was not bin Laden, particularly if you were that person, because you would be no more. And the other downside was if they missed and it was bin Laden, that target would disappear. They would lose the opportunity. So I would suggest that a more timid president would have done what Vice President Biden recommended, which was do nothing, wait and gather more intelligence so that we know for sure who this is. A more cautious president would have taken that missile shot, which is what Secretary Gates recommended and what the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Jim Cartwright, recommended. The fact is that in making this choice, the President took the riskiest option available to him, but the one with the biggest upside. And, he risked, in making that choice, obviously the men who undertook the mission, but he also risked our relationship with Pakistan and very clearly risked any possibility of being reelected for a second term. Now, when I tell these stories, more than I think most journalists of my generation, I'm interested in storytelling. I think a lot of journalists who got in the business as I did in the 1970s were motivated by making the world a better place, exposing corruption, sending dirty politicians to jail, all of which are very worthy and legitimate reasons for becoming a journalist. From the beginning, I've always been primarily motivated by trying to tell good, true stories, to write compellingly. And when you do that, if that's your approach, you ask a lot of different questions than most journalists ask. I'm interested in looking at a story in what is this, in essence, what is the story about? Who are the main characters in the story? How do those characters change and develop over the course, in this case, of the 10 years it took to find bin Laden? What are the major actions that took place, that advanced the story? And simple questions like, or what sounds like a simple question, where does the story begin? And where does the story end? And you would think that for someone who writes true stories, the answer to that question would be very simple. But in truth, history does not unfold in neatly packaged segments for nonfiction writers to come along and scoop up off the pavement. The decision about where a story begins and where a story ends is every bit as creative and difficult for a nonfiction writer as it is a novelist. So for me, this story began in earnest on 9/11 of 2001 rather, and I begin the book by telling the story of that day through the eyes of a number of the characters who will be key to the story at the end. Among them, Barack Obama, who has evolved quite a bit since 2001. Michael Morell, who was on 2001 September 11th, was President Bush's national security advisor. Traveled, spent the day with him on Air Force One because Secret Service was unsure about the nature of the threat, whether they should even put the president down on the ground. Later, Michael goes on to become one of the architects in the CIA of the finding that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which he'll tell you was not only his largest professional, personal failure, but one of the biggest intelligence failures in American history. And then, finally, in this case, as deputy director of the CIA, telling the president that even though the estimates that bin Laden was actually there ranged from 95% to some of the guys working for him at CIA to as low as 40% from the National Counterterrorism Center, that he personally placed the certainty at 60% and that he was never going to go higher than that again in his life. He says, I'm the guy who believed there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I'm never going to be more than 60% certain about anything again. If I had an eyewitness, he said, who told me bin Laden was in that compound, I would still be at 60%. Those of us who are old enough remember, you know, what a discredited agency the CIA was in years past, in the 1970s with the findings of the Church Committee of attempted assassinations overseas and spying on American citizens. And there's hardly a movie that comes out of Hollywood that doesn't cast as chief villains someone working for the CIA. Guys who work and women who work for the CIA are very used to this. They're used to being regarded askance by most of America, wondering what they're really up to and whether it's worthwhile. He said that as he left the White House the night they killed bin Laden, he remembered hearing the crowd across the street from the White House chanting, CIA, CIA. He said, Mark, I almost cried. He said, I never thought I would hear that in my life. One more little story, and then I'll let Greg have the microphone. For me, it was a thrill to interview the President of the United States. I had never done that before for a story. And you would think after 10 books and 40 years of this work that I would be an old pro at this point. So I show up at the White House. I'm escorted in to meet the president. I sit down, and it's just a fantastic interview. He told me, they originally said I'd have an hour. He eventually talked to me for an hour and a half and spoke candidly, I think, and thoughtfully and in depth about every question that I asked. And it was an amazing interview, clearly one of the more important interviews for this book, maybe one of the most important in my career. And as I got up to say goodbye and I looked down, this old master's tape recorder had died. And I had no idea how long it had gone, during this interview. So you can imagine the sinking feeling in my gut as I'm saying goodbye and leaving the Oval Office, I'm not taking, scribbling notes rapidly because I figure, I'm recording this, right? So as we're leaving, I said to Ben Rhodes, who was sat in on this interview, he's one of the president's speechwriters and advisors, I said, Ben, you're not going to believe this, but my recorder died in the middle of that. And he says, don't worry about it. We record everything in here. We'll get you a transcript before you leave. And he did. Thank you very much.
It's a tough act to follow. For someone who, like myself, who's just starting out writing narrative nonfiction, it's a bit like following up Springsteen or Bono. So I'm a big fan of Mark. I could listen to him tell stories all day. I grew up in Nebraska, not far away from here, and so it's a real treat for me to be here in Denver at the Tattered Cover, which I think is an absolutely spectacular bookstore. I just want to chat a little bit, and then I'm going to read you a couple of pages, and then I think we'll take some questions. I first went to Yemen almost a decade ago. I went in 2003, and the first day I was there, a guy who would turn out to be very, very important and very influential in my life and in my time in Yemen, threw me a plastic bag of leaves, what Yemenis call khat. They chew this in the afternoon. They stick it in their cheek until eventually they get this big tennis ball sized wad of khat, essentially. And this guy threw me this bag and he said, chew. And it was some of the best advice anyone has ever given me. For the rest of that year and then for the past several years, I've been going to Yemen, sitting down and chatting with people, largely in these khat chews. And Yemenis are incredibly warm, incredibly generous people. And so from the hours of 2 o'clock in the afternoon all the way up until what they call Saya Salamaniya, which is the hour of Solomon, which is this time about when the sun starts to set over the mountains in Sana'a, you can sort of see the sun rays come through these alabaster windows. Yemenis will sit and they will tell you everything about their country, about their history. They'll talk to you. They'll give you lessons in Arabic. And this has been a real treat for me. And this has really been my education in the country, has largely been with a group of guys who I thank in the book that I spent time chewing khat with them, talking with them every day. In fact, one of the most touching things one of them said to me once was that his version of heaven had the five of us sitting around chewing khat in the afternoon and watching TV. That's what he thought would be the absolute best thing. I started thinking about this book in November 2002. I was in the Peace Corps in Jordan, and the U.S. carried out a drone strike that killed a guy by the name of Abu Ali al-Harithi, as well as the rest of the individuals who were in the car, including one man who had American citizenship. And I really wanted to go to Yemen, and eventually the next year I made it there. It took about 6 years for me to feel comfortable enough, both with knowing Arabic, with spending time in Yemen, in order to feel like I had sort of a grasp on what was taking place. And in fact, it wasn't until November 2008, little over 4 years ago now, that I was browsing, as is typical in a bookstore, not unlike this one, in Kramer Books, and afterwards Cafe in Washington, D.C., when sort of really all the pieces came together, and I felt as though it was that I was ready to tell the story of how al-Qaeda had sort of formed in Yemen and how the group had rebounded. At that same time in Yemen, President Obama has just been elected president. He's just about to be sworn in, to be inaugurated in January of 2009. At the same time, there's a group there in Yemen that is coming back together and is about to announce their merger into what we now know as Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, or AQAP. And so the couple of pages that I'm going to read to you are from that exact time, that time from November 2008 to January 2009, when I first felt ready to start telling this story, when President Obama was just preparing for his first term in office, and when this group of outlaws in the mountains north of Sana'a was starting to come together. And there are three characters in these couple of pages. One is a young Yemeni journalist. He sort of has wavy hair. He favors glasses not unlike mine, very, very stylish. And this is a guy by the name of Abdelilah Shea. The other character is an individual by the name of Nasser al-Waheshi. And this is a guy who is Yemeni. In the 1990s, he went off to Afghanistan, and he became Osama bin Laden's, basically his intern, sort of his assistant, his aide-de-camp, really for 4 years, from about 1998 all the way up until the Battle of Tora Bora. And he was one of the guys who escaped. Eventually, he came back to Yemen, part of a prison break, and he rebuilt. Really, he was the individual when we talk about the underwear bomber on Christmas Day 2009, when we talk about the latest underwear bomb plot or the parcel bomb plots, this is the guy who's ordering them. This guy, he's very short. He's about this tall. He has sunken cheeks, very, very soft-spoken, but very charismatic, and he has sort of this beard that juts out almost like a billy goat's, if you will. This is the second character. This is the guy who used the blueprint Osama bin Laden used in Afghanistan to rebuild the organization in Yemen. And then the third guy is a Saudi. And this is a guy by the name of Said al-Shihri. And this is a guy who spent several years in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, before being released by the U.S. back to Saudi Arabia, who put him through this rehabilitation program. When he got through the rehabilitation program, they said, "Do you want a wife?" He said, "No." They said, "Do you want a job?" He said, "No." And they released him to his family. And a few months after they released him to his family, he called a bunch of guys that he'd met in prison, many of them people he'd known in Guantanamo Bay, some he'd met in Saudi Arabia. And he basically held this dinner for all these, what Saudi thought were former terrorists. And he convinced many of them to join him and to head across the border into Yemen. And so that's sort of where we'll pick up this story. And al-Qaeda is about to announce this merger between the Yemeni and the Saudi branches. Let me make sure yep. And so this journalist has been selected. I talked to a lot of journalists in Yemen in interviews for this book. This journalist was invited by al-Qaeda to come and sort of have an exclusive sit-down interview in many of the same ways that Mark had his exclusive interview with President Obama. And so here's the story, and it takes place in December 2008 and January of 2009. So soon after Shaikh submitted his questions, word came back that al-Qaeda was ready. The journalist was not allowed to bring his laptop, cell phone, or anything electronic that intelligence agencies could use to pinpoint their location. Al-Qaeda would take care of everything. Armed guards patted Shaya down and blindfolded him before putting him in the car al-Qaeda had sent. When the men removed the blindfold, Shaya was standing in the middle of a bare room surrounded by several young men. In front of him, sitting at a small table, was an open laptop al-Qaeda had arranged for his use. A slim man in a black checked headdress with gray-flecked beard motioned for Shaya to sit next to him. Greeting him in a Saudi accent, the man showed Shaya the green vest he was wearing. "Do you know what this is?" he asked. Looking into the stranger's face, Shaya sensed he was being teased. "I don't know," he stuttered. "Some sort of a pack." "It's a suicide vest," the man said, taking the straps off his shoulders and draping them over Shaya. "Don't be scared." Shaya had never seen a suicide vest in person, and he froze as the Saudi eased the heavy pack down onto his chest. "There are enough explosives in here to take out two floors," the man bragged. Slowly, as Shaya struggled to control his breathing, the Saudi demonstrated how the bomb worked, showing him the deep pockets for explosives and the small detonator switch that triggered everything. "I'm never apart from this," the man breathed, gently running his hand over the rough green fabric. Sensing the discomfort on Shaya's face, the Saudi prodded him. "Go ahead, feel it for yourself," he instructed. "Run your hands over the top." Shaya blanched and tried to move, but his hand wouldn't respond. "Stop," the man barked. "Don't touch that, you'll set the bomb off." No one in the room moved. Slowly, the man's face crinkled into a smile. It was a joke. Chuckling softly, the Saudi lifted the vest back off of Shaya's chest and introduced himself as Said al-Shihri, a former detainee at Guantanamo Bay. Shaya tried to calm himself and remember his questions during the round of introductions that followed. Minutes later, a throng of masked gunmen slipped into the room, signaling Wahashi's arrival. Stealing yet another page from bin Laden's playbook, the young al-Qaeda commander wanted to make the sort of dramatic appearance his hero had perfected in Afghanistan. Shaya watched as the others greeted the little man in the light blue robe and white turban. He'd seen Wahashi's mugshot, but in person, the al-Qaeda commander seemed even smaller. His sharp nose and sunken cheeks masked by the tufts of facial hair that jutted out from his face. Soon it was Shaya's turn. The sheikh was standing right in front of him. Wahashi shook the journalist's hand and embraced him with a gentle smile. "Welcome," he said. "Sit here beside me." Shaya wanted to start the interview, but Wahashi shook his head. "We have certain obligations," he said as aides brought out tea and cold drinks. A few minutes later, several plates of food appeared. Shaya's face registered surprise. He hadn't expected hospitality from terrorists. Wahashi noted his reaction, but instead of commenting, the al-Qaeda leader merely raised his eyebrows politely. As he finished the food hospitality dictated he consume, Shea realized he had no idea who these men were. This wasn't the Al-Qaeda he had read about. For the next 90 minutes, Wahashi tried to educate him, walking the young journalist through the religious justification for Al-Qaeda's past attacks and laying out their plans to, quote, cleanse the Arabian Peninsula. The soft-spoken Al-Qaeda commander politely evaded questions about the death of innocent Muslims like Susan al-Banna, who'd been killed in an attack on the U.S. embassy months earlier, and laughed off Shea's attempt to portray Ali Abdullah Saleh as a legitimate ruler in Yemen. What elections, he protested. At the end of the interview, Wahashi stood up to escort Shea to the door. Remember, he cautioned, the interview's embargoed until we let you know. The Al-Qaeda leader had one more surprise. A few days later, and about 6,000 miles away, Barack Obama was coming to his own decision. On January 22, 2009, his second full day in office, the newly elected president signed the executive order he'd promised during his campaign. Seated at a table in the West Wing, in front of a group of retired military officers, Obama promised to close Guantanamo Bay and, quote, restore the standards of due process and the core constitutional values that made this country great, even in the midst of war. The next day, Wahashi released his surprise. Along with the Shea interview, the Al-Qaeda commander had put together a short video featuring himself, Saeed Shihri, Qasem al-Raimi, the military commander of the new group, and Mohammed Al-Ofi, another former Guantanamo Bay detainee. The four represented AQAP's new leadership, two Yemenis and two Saudis. Wahashi's 19-minute video put a face on the worst fears of some in the U.S. government. Men the U.S. had once had in custody were free and threatening to kill Americans. By God, we are coming, AQAP's leader swore into the camera. We will bring delight to the eyes of our mothers in Palestine and Gaza, they promised. Quote, either we will come to them with the flags of jihad, waving above steeds of war with the determination of our forefathers, or we will die in this cause. As bin Laden had years earlier, AQAP left no doubt. It was targeting the U.S. Thank you very much.
All right, I am going to, if you ask questions, and Greg will do the same, sort of summarize and repeat the question. And this is not because I'm autistic, but because this is being recorded for a podcast, and they're not going to be able to hear you when you ask us questions. So I hope you do. Yes, sir, back here. Yeah, either for Greg or I. Tell us.
For you.
Okay.
My question would be, how would you compare your book to No Easy Day?
The question is comparing my book to the book written by a Navy SEAL about who took part in the raid called No Easy Day. First of all, I should note that he chose the pseudonym Mark Owen, which is just two little letters away. I was sort of flattered by that, you know. And I kind of think that in the stampede to buy his book, which is a huge success, some people will accidentally buy mine, so I'm really happy. His book is an account of his life as a SEAL, how he became a SEAL, how he trained, the various missions that he went on over 10 years. And it culminates with the only first-person account that we've had of the raid itself. My book is a book about essentially a much larger overview about how the United States responded to the attacks of 2001, how we constituted basically a new fusion of intelligence analysis and collection and special operations, how that targeting engine works, how it found bin Laden, how the president decided to act, what his options were. Most of the action in my story takes place in Langley, Virginia, or the White House, or the Pentagon. And both books conclude with an account of the raid. His, which I recommend, is a very thrilling account from his own perspective. Mine is an account from a lot of different perspectives, from debriefings of the SEALs who went on the raid, from Admiral McRaven, who commanded it from Jalalabad, to folks in the White House and folks at Langley who supervised that raid. So they're different books, vastly different in ambition, I think, but both of them end on the same very exciting four-hour mission. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Can you comment on the decision to kill rather than capture
Bin Laden? The question is to comment on the decision to kill rather than capture Bin Laden. The order that the president gave was to capture him if possible and kill him if necessary. He told me that he believed it unlikely that they would be able to capture Bin Laden. He told me, the president said he would probably have had to have been naked and on the ground to have been taken captive. Nevertheless, he said he preferred that he be taken alive because the president, as Greg referred in his talk, has tried with an effort to close down Guantanamo, has made a consistent effort to bring top-level terrorists to trial in criminal courts. He believes that's the appropriate venue for them. There's a tremendous amount of political opposition to that, which has basically prevented him from doing it. You may recall his effort to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in Manhattan, which was resisted by the mayor, by every political figure in New York, and a fairly united conservative opposition. The president said that he felt that if they captured Bin Laden, he might have the political capital to make that happen. And I think he was sincere in that. However, these men who take part in these raids are risking their lives. You don't ask them to take every possible risk with their own safety. And then, you know, when they landed on the compound and approached the house, they were fired upon. They returned fire and killed the person shooting at them. But in my opinion, the fate of every adult male in that house was sealed at that point, because those men were not about to wait to see if they were going to be fired upon again. And so they very methodically went through that house, and they killed every adult male they encountered. The last person was Bin Laden. You can second-guess that all you like. I think if I was in a dark room, dark house, someone had just shot at me, a lot of adrenaline pulsing through my veins, I would be inclined to shoot first and ask questions later, and I suggest that's why they did what they did. Yes, ma'am.
This is for Mr. Johnson. Good. You mentioned in the past that Obama's counterterrorism policy, the airstrikes and the drones, don't leave much space on the ground for people in Yemen to fight against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. If that policy were changed, do you think there's a will and a desire among the power brokers there to fight back and kind of counter al-Qaeda?
Yeah, that's a great question. The question is, referring to some of my previous remarks, not here tonight, that President Obama's counterterrorism strategy, particularly in Yemen, which relies heavily on drone strikes and airstrikes, actually reduces the space in which Yemenis themselves can step up and confront al-Qaeda. And the question is whether there is will among the Yemeni elite to actually do that. I think what we've seen in Yemen, and we've sort of taken a step back tonight and looked at 4 years ago, 3 years ago, almost 3 years ago, was when al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula put the would-be suicide bomber on the plane, and thankfully for all of us, he failed to bring down that airliner over Detroit. Since that time, the U.S. has been carrying out airstrikes, drone strikes in Yemen from December 2009 all the way up to today. In fact, just hours after President Obama won re-election, there was a drone strike that took out a suspected al-Qaeda target there in Yemen. The U.S. operates what are called signature strikes, which basically allows them to carry out drone or airstrikes even if they don't know the identity of the particular individual on the ground. So someone who exhibits suspicious behavior goes to a house that the U.S. knows that that al-Qaeda members frequent and so forth. And in these 3 years, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula has went from about 200 or 300 individuals up to at least 1,000 in the estimates of John Brennan. The State Department says several, or a few thousand, rather. And so my point, and I think the point of a number of people who look at this, is that instead of disrupting, dismantling, and defeating al-Qaeda, the airstrikes, the drone strikes in Yemen are actually exacerbating the problem, and they're expanding it. I'm not anti-drone or anti-airstrike, but I think the U.S. has such poor human intelligence on the ground, and it carries out so many airstrikes and so many drone strikes that it's not the strikes themselves, it's the civilian casualties that are enraging so many people in Yemen and that are really helping to drive the numbers of al-Qaeda up. And I think what we've seen is that Yemen has a lot of problems. This is a country, 60 years ago it was 6 million people. Today it's 26 million people. There's hardly any employment. There's no water, very little oil. It's a very impoverished country. But there is a will to step up against al-Qaeda. And we've seen this from particular people. And I think now that President Saleh is out of power, there are still people who would continue to use this, but that there is a will there. I'll just end with one brief anecdote that I think really gets at the conundrum that the U.S. is in places like Yemen. There was a guy out in Hadramut, which is in the eastern part of Yemen, who does exactly what the U.S. wants him to do. He's a cleric in a mosque, and he goes to the mosque, and he preaches against al-Qaeda. He says what it is that al-Qaeda is doing has no place within Islam. These are not Islamic actions. There's no place for jihad within Yemen. Yemen is not a legitimate theater for jihad. And he's making real progress. People are starting to question what it is that al-Qaeda is doing, and it gets to the point that al-Qaeda actually has to come to him and tell him to knock it off. And they have a meeting, and they want him to tone down his rhetoric. Unfortunately, this meeting is attacked by a U.S. drone, and the anti-al-Qaeda cleric is killed.
Yes, sir.
My question is to Mr. Bowie.
Yes.
The question is, why did the Obama administration discard the body of bin Laden very soon after he was killed into the Arabian Sea? Why the pictures of his body were not put on display? What was the reason for that? And the hope that I not give the standard answer. In fact, I think what to do with bin Laden's body was of concern to the administration. I wrote a book about Pablo Escobar, who was hunted down and killed in Colombia in 1993. And if you go to Medellin today, the burial place of Pablo Escobar is a point of pilgrimage for many in Colombia. It's mounded with flowers and photographs. So I think there was a legitimate concern that the burial of bin Laden somewhere would create a focus for extremists to demonstrate their faith and whatnot. There was, I think, a concern for observing, for basically behaving in a civilized and dignified manner. Muslim burials call for burial within 24 hours. So I think there was a decision made to honor the dignity of that faith. They did offer to return bin Laden's body to Saudi Arabia, the place of his birth, where his family is from. The Saudi officials said, what other plan do you have? And the United States said, we'll bury him at sea if you don't want the body back. And they said, we like your plan. So for all those reasons, I think that's why they did what they did. And they made the decision not to show the photographs just because they were grotesque. They were, again, an extremely undignified thing to do. And as the president put it, and I believe him, he felt that it would be like spiking the football in the end zone. And while some on his, I think, staff did the equivalent of that when they gave interviews sort of aggrandizing glorifying what action they had taken without any necessity, that has been honored. And we haven't seen any of those pictures. And I imagine someday we will. Something like that doesn't stay secret forever. But I believe that's the truth, too. Yes, sir.
Yes, question for both authors. Play devil's advocate for a minute.
seems that after a decade of war, the American public is completely disassociated from what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. What you describe seems a far cry from Nebraska and Denver. My question is, philosophically, do you think that we should allow those who are in charge to continue solving our problems, and the American public should go on with its daily lives and be concerned about Black Friday shopping and unemployment rates and the price of gas? Or is there a much larger threat out there that you all see from what you've studied and researched and discussed?
Greg, you want to go first?
You're much wiser. You should.
Oh. The question was about the distance that the American public seems to have from the war fighting that's going on continually. We've had a decade of war. You mentioned Iraq and Afghanistan. And most Americans are living lives completely disassociated from those military efforts. And the question was whether I think it's wise that we, as a country, continue along that path, and whether I foresee, you know, that there's any large threats looming from this. Is that an accurate summary? You know, it's a problem in this country. War fighting has always been something of an issue where there's no draft. You know, when there's a draft and everyone serves, there is, you know, it brings the war home to many Americans. The military hates the draft because the officers are burdened with soldiers who don't want to be there. And so, generally speaking, if the Army can recruit and raise the necessary forces, they prefer to have a volunteer professional force, and that force has served us all very well. But there's no question that there's a downside to that, which is a kind of disconnect with normal American life. Too few families, you know, really are asked to sacrifice when we go to war. I do think, though, having said that, that given global telecommunications, our fighting in the last 10 years has been a much larger presence in the lives of most Americans than, say, Vietnam was. Soldiers in the field today, as we've all seen, you know, take pictures with their cell phones, sometimes horrible pictures that the government would prefer not to see. The pictures taken at Abu Ghraib were snapped by soldiers and put up on the internet. The use of email enables soldiers to be in touch with their friends and families and communities to a far greater extent. The military has loosened up its rules about journalism, so they've embedded soldiers with units in Iraq and Afghanistan, and there's any number of really fine reports and books and movies that have been made. So in that sense, I think we are much more aware as a country of what's going on with our military than we were in years past. We don't need a draft at this point, so I don't think we're likely to have one. I think we've withdrawn from Iraq. We're dialing down, for better or for worse, from Afghanistan, and the war that we're going to keep on fighting is, I think, going to be one that we'll fight for a long time, and by its nature will be out of sight. It'll involve particularly special ops and the CIA, and I think that, personally, I think that's the appropriate way to fight this war. As for your question about larger threats looming on the horizon, I don't think that they're there to the extent that they were 10 years ago. I think that the Al-Qaeda that Osama bin Laden founded was a remarkably sophisticated international organization linked by global telecommunications. To do the attacks on 9/11 cost about $250,000, involved recruiting suicide hijackers from all over the region, transporting them to the United States, getting them flight training, arranging for them to arrive at precisely the right moment to hijack four different planes and attack, you know, these various places in the United States. That was an unprecedented operation that required a tremendous degree of skill and sophistication. That organization is defunct, I believe. I think the death of Osama bin Laden was a capstone. There are still people out there who belong to that organization, but it was almost like black comedy reading bin Laden's letters in the last months of his life as he's replacing his number three man every 2 or 3 months because everybody who gets the job gets killed. So I don't think that threat is there. I think what you see now, as Greg is talking about in Yemen, are local organizations that fly the Al-Qaeda flag to attract recruits, to aggrandize themselves, and they are a real danger in their neighborhoods. But they are not, they don't pose the same kind of threat right now that the original Al-Qaeda did to the United States. Do you want to add anything?
See, this is why you go first. You're much more comprehensive than I could be. I think I would add just two very brief points to what it is that Mark said. And one is, while I do think that there's a role to play for drones and the technology that the United States has advanced over the past decade, I mean, this is, to me, one of the most frustrating things, is it's a self-evident truth, I think, to all of us in this room, that Al-Qaeda is this horrible terrorist organization. Even when you read their theology in Arabic, it's incredibly shallow. It's stuff that can be easily refuted. And yet, for all of the United States money, for all of our efforts, and for all of our technology, in a place like Yemen, we're still losing. And that to me, after traveling to the country for a decade, is very, very frustrating to see. And I think one of the things that we see with the rise of this technology is that it's a very seductive thing, in that you can almost, and I think the mistake that the Obama administration has made, is to see drone strikes, airstrikes, as the totality of the solution. And I don't think that will in fact work. I think if it's the United States against Al-Qaeda in Yemen, that's a war that the United States is always going to lose. It has to be Yemen against Al-Qaeda, with the U.S. helping Yemen. And I don't think that's what's happening. I think what we're seeing is that the United States is attempting to fight wars in places like Yemen without skin in the game, as Obama said about the conflict in Libya and attempting to bring in the Arab League and others. The other thing that I would mention just briefly is I think that politicians of both parties, and in fact, the way that the discourse and the narrative has been portrayed in the United States, is that our officials, whether they be Republican or Democrat, whoever is in power has to have 100%, has to have a perfect batting average. They have to prevent every attack. And any attack, no matter how small, is a disaster and viewed as a failure. And that's not the attitude that is in other places. Obviously, we want to stop all of these attacks, but how far? I mean, you go back and you read Edward Gibbon in Decline and Fall, and he's talking about the same things, about people being more enamored of their security than of their freedoms. And that's a debate and a discussion that I think we're starting to have much more now than we did a few years ago. And so I think that's sort of one of the positive things that's come out as the Obama administration has talked about what it is that they're doing. Obviously, much of this is still covert, but being as open as they think they can be, that I think we as the public, the people who are sending our representatives to Washington, are able to have a more vigorous debate about this.
Yes, sir.
Have you ever thought of writing a book on all of the problems with Palestine and the Israelis?
Is that for me or is that for Greg?
It's for you. Yeah.
The question is whether I've ever thought about writing a book about the long-standing struggle between Israel and the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. To be honest, I have not thought about doing that. There are so many journalists who have made a career out of covering that conflict, Israelis and Arabs, Americans as well. I did go to the West Bank and Gaza in 1988 for the first Intifada, and that was really my first introduction to that struggle. I remember being questioned by the LL security teams at the airport in New York. I don't know if anybody here has traveled to the Middle East. It has had the great pleasure of being screened by LL. This is the Israeli security force, very effective. And they were asking me, so why are you going to Israel? And I said, well, I'm a newspaper reporter. I'm here to cover my paper's sending me to cover the Intifada. They said, well, do you speak Arabic? I said, no. Do you speak Hebrew? No. Do you know anything about the history of the Arab-Israeli conflict? As much as any average American does, but no. Have you ever written about any of this before? No. They said, well, why is your newspaper sending you to cover this? I said, because newspapers do dumb things like this all the time, you know? Go ask them why they're sending me. I learned a great deal. But like most things, when you begin to learn, you learn how much you don't know. And that's a subject matter that I think there are people far better qualified than I am to write about. There may be at some point, and there has never been yet, a particular story that might pique my curiosity. One of them was, there was that sequence of photographs a few years ago of the father and son, and where was it, in Gaza or the West Bank, that were gunned down. I mean, something like that, that's very particular, that I could investigate in the way that I like to do, that might be an exception. But other than that, I'm not about to try and tackle one of the most intractable problems in the world. Greg, do you want to answer that as well?
My answer is no.
Okay, can we do one more? Do one more and then we'll...
We'd like to do some closing remarks after your final question.
All right. Yes, sir.
This question's for both of you gentlemen. With what you're seeing now with Al-Qaeda, you're seeing them no longer necessarily a global organization, but you see them getting involved, such as in Benghazi, the attack there. And now there are reports in the free press about them getting involved in Syria, possibly, and now in Gaza. So where do you see the future of Al-Qaeda 5-10 years from now?
Greg, why don't you go first? You're the Al-Qaeda expert.
Certainly. I think that's a great question. And in fact, one of the shortcomings that I think we often have, not only us here in this room, but when I talk to people in the U.S. national security establishment, is we view Al-Qaeda only as a terrorist organization. And let's not beat around the bush. They are that. But that isn't everything that the organization sees itself as. The organization sees itself as being a group, like in Yemen, when Ali Abdullah Saleh was the president of Yemen, he's been president for more than 3 decades. When he was in the midst of this so-called Arab Spring, Al-Qaeda took over large portions of the country, and they did things like they brought in electricity to places that had never had electricity. They dug water wells in villages that didn't have water wells. There had been schools. There's a village. It's very hard to get to in southern Yemen. They'd been petitioning the Yemeni government for 3 years to provide teachers. No teachers ever came. Al-Qaeda guy shows up. They see that there are no teachers in the school. Within 2 weeks, there's a bunch of Al-Qaeda guys in the school, and you can imagine what it is that they're teaching the young boys. So the seeds of future generations of terrorists, I think they're being sown now in an environment that's much more radical than the one that Osama bin Laden came of age in. And for Al-Qaeda, particularly for the group in Yemen, they see attacks in Yemen as a means to an end, whereas attacks against the United States are an end in and of themselves. And so Al-Qaeda, as I think Mark's absolutely correct when he says that the Al-Qaeda that Osama bin Laden founded, that's dead. But Al-Qaeda itself, the different Al-Qaeda, how it's morphed and how it's mutated and how it's changed, is very much still alive. And I think Mark's correct that they don't have the capability to sort of launch a September 11th attack again, but they do have the capability to, say, do something or attempt to do something like they did on Christmas Day 3 years ago.
Yeah, I agree with Greg. I think we'll be living with the threat of terrorist attacks, small-scale individuals who blow themselves up or, like Timothy McVeigh, explode a government building, or a soldier at Fort Hood who comes into a room and opens up with an automatic rifle. I think that's a permanent feature of life that we have to live with. The larger threat, you know, which we feared after 9/11, that there would be this well-funded international organization that might get its hands on chemical or biological weapons and kill hundreds of thousands of people, that might get their hands on a nuclear weapon even. You know, those were, I think, very real concerns that have diminished greatly in the last 10 years. I think I'm pretty optimistic, actually, about the ultimate fate of Al-Qaeda. I think that these revolutions throughout the Middle East are probably the most useful thing that's happened, even though in some countries Islamist extremists are being elected to office, because what they've done by ridding their countries of these despotic regimes is given people a peaceful, nonviolent avenue for political change and political expression. And in the long run, I think those are the things that will ultimately defeat these extremists who are viewed, frankly, in most of those countries as a threat and a nuisance and a problem. And so I think as, you know, the civil society emerges, a more democratic society in these countries, they're the ones, as Greg said, you know, the only one who can defeat Al-Qaeda in Yemen are the Yemenis. And I think that, you know, we as a country ought to be doing everything we can, and I think the administration is, to encourage the development of democratic forms, have elections, set, create, you know, institutions that guard government by consent as opposed to government by fear. Do you have a, do you want to make a final remark?
I think you summed it up pretty well.
Well, thanks.
Yeah.
I've been doing this a long time.
Yeah, well, you're very good. I'm taking mental notes.
We're not going to take any more questions. I'm sorry, we have to wrap it up. I do. I'll tell you one little story, and then we'll cut it off. I've often been asked to talk to like high school graduates and things like that, and I always try to encourage people to temper their opinions about the world with their level of knowledge, with to be mindful of your ignorance. And no one could be more mindful than I am of my ignorance, because the more you travel, the more you learn, the more you understand how little you know, and also the more you realize how different and complex places are than you ever imagined. When I wrote my book, Guest of the Ayatollah, I took three separate trips to Tehran to do reporting, and on one of them I was standing on the sidewalk for someone to take a picture of me in front of a giant mural of the Ayatollah Khomeini. And an Iranian guy walking down the sidewalk says, "What do you want a picture of that asshole for?" And I don't think he was talking about me. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.